Working Cows Podcast, episode 171.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Howdy, everybody. It's Clay Connery, host of the Working Cows Podcast. Really excited today to be back with another episode powered by the Global Ag Network. And we're joined today by Peter Ballerstedt, the sod father of the Ruminati, so to speak. He's at Grass Based on a whole bunch of different social media platforms, and he will be those links will be in the show notes page for today, workingcows.net/171. So it's good to be joined by him. He's got quite the background. We're going to talk to him quite a bit today about his background, but we're going to start off talking to him about the short stave principle, or Liebig's barrel, and we'll define that and talk a little bit more about what that is as we get started. But for now, let's welcome him to the Working Cows Podcast. Peter, thanks for joining me today on the Working Cows Podcast.
Pleasure, Clay. Thanks for the invitation.
I've been really enjoying your recently launched podcast and been able to consume quite a few of the episodes over the last few days. And one of the topics that continues to come up over and over again in the podcast, and you even did a standalone episode on it, is Liebig's barrel, or the short stave idea. So could you talk a little bit about what is that idea, and what are some of the thoughts connected to it?
Sure. Well, Liebig's barrel, as I learned it in soil fertility, was an illustration of the law of the minimum, that you could have an abundance of other nutrients, but yield was going to be limited by whatever element was in shortest supply relative to its requirement. So the barrel analogy, imagine, you know, a wooden rain or wine barrel with different length staves, and the shortest stave is going to set the volume for the barrel. You can't hold any more water than that short stave will allow. You can increase the length of all the other staves all you want. You're not going to hold more water. So if phosphorus is limiting, adding more nitrogen isn't the answer. Once you've raised phosphorus levels to the point where they're no longer limiting, then some other nutrient becomes limiting, and you keep that adjustment process going. If you put too much of the wrong nutrient in, the least will happen is you'll not achieve economic return. The worst that could happen is, in addition to that, you could create a toxicity situation. So again, I learned that in soil fertility, but you can apply it in a number of other ways. So I work in the forage seed industry, and I could sell somebody a variety of, I'll just say, tall fescue that would yield more. Well, but if the problem is that they don't have sufficient control of their stock to make sure that, you know, with fencing or temporary fencing or water supplies, to utilize what they already have in a controlled way, then giving them even more may actually not be beneficial to them. If we're going into an area of the country where tall fescue is already the base forage, then chances are you can push the supply a couple weeks one way or the other, but you've probably got holes elsewhere that you could do better, maybe with a completely different crop and working out a more distributed forage calendar, for example. So, and then in the video that I posted, I was trying to apply it to public health and saying, I believe that there's a unifying insult. And until we address that, then, you know, we're not going to see the progress that we need to see to address the chronic disease epidemic.
We've got some time slated today, and I'd like to talk to you a little bit more about that chronic health epidemic that we're seeing, and talk a little bit more about that, maybe even in a bonus episode. So we'll see what we can get accomplished today. But I guess where I'd like to go from there is to kind of jump off into what are some of those limiting factors. Do those limiting factors change given topography, given ecosystem, given region of the country? Does sandy soil typically have a limiting factor, or is management history and context always the overriding limiting factor, and getting those things management hammered out can kind of cover a multitude of sins, so to speak?
Really good question. And the short answer is yes. The little bit more detailed answer is that management trumps everything, right? So if I have two operations that are immediately adjoining each other in exactly the same topography, same soil type, same genetics in the herd, et cetera, but they're two different managers, two different families, very different situations, and you know that from your experience. So that has to be kept in mind the whole time, that there are very good reasons that manager A would decide to do something that manager B would decide not to. And as long as it fits within a decision process, then that's perfectly valid. For example, somebody who's approaching retirement isn't going to be making the investments that somebody who is just, maybe mid-career would consider making in the way of inputs. Number two is the history of how a soil has been managed. If, for example, we're going into a previously cropped piece of ground, then we've got a different situation than if we're managing a native grass stand. For all the reasons that you could imagine, impact of tillage, the export of nutrients from the cropping system, how well those nutrients were replaced, et cetera. Clearly, anything in the way of topography is going to impact, but ultimately, rainfall, water availability trumps everything, right? Mm-hmm. Growing season is another one of those. So If I was speaking to somebody recently and they said they're growing bananas in Iceland. Well, yeah, you can only do that when you have geothermal and hydropower and cheap electricity, right? Mm-hmm. We can put a lot of inputs into something to get the change that we want, but nature votes last. And we're likely to see the bigger the inputs, the more unexpected and the larger the responses could be. In other places, they talk about the law of small numbers, small input, small response. So those are some ideas. Ultimately, we get to what nature in that environment is establishing as a constraint. And so, for example, in a rangeland situation, growing season, moisture during the growing season, and then soil characteristics are going to be the ones that probably are going to be ones that are most resistant to us changing. We can adjust things about soil to a greater or lesser extent, and we can maybe introduce some more productive species or species that would produce at a different time, those sorts of things. And then, of course, we've got the wild card of we've got the harvesting equipment that's out there roaming on this grass stand, which itself has an effect. So back to the first analogy of if you don't have control of the stock, that ought to be the first input that you look at before you start the rest of the plan. So setting up the good fencing system, how you're going to move animals around through the various pastures, how making sure that they have water, those sorts of things, working facilities, how you're going to get animals to a place to work them when you need to, those sorts of questions probably are more important than buying a new variety of X species. As heretical as that might be in the seed industry.
Yeah, and you work for a seed company, right?
Yes, I do.
I guess maybe the oversight so far for my role as host would be that we haven't talked about how do I determine what my shortest stave is.
Well, okay, so first we should be, what kinds of records are we keeping? So we can't manage what we don't measure in some way. And one approach that I got some time ago was to estimate yield, however you're going to do that. Is that grazing days? Is that AMUs? Are you actually out there estimating pre and post grazing residuals? So anything along that spectrum, keep track of for each of your paddocks, each of your individual pastures. Then compare them to each other. So you're not worried about your neighbors. What is average on your property? And then, or the property that you're leasing and managing, and then look for those that fall significantly below your average and try to determine, is it because they're an unproductive stand? So for example, if it's all bluegrass versus some other species, or is it something to do with the soil, which you would estimate through soil sampling? Is it moisture? You know, is it too much, too little? Is that anything that you can affect? And that's the process that I would suggest using to address or to start identifying which are the problem areas, and then drilling in, so to speak, into those areas to see why are these below the average for this property? And then what could be done to address those?
Yep. And I appreciate, you know, the statement that you said that, you know, in almost any context, if you are not able to control access to the forage, that's your first input. That, you know, as, and I think I just quoted this on the last episode as well, but as Joel Salatin said, we have the ability to put an accelerator, a brake, and a steering wheel on that cow herd through electric fencing or whatever species it is that you're managing. We have those 21st century options, and we should take advantage of those, I guess.
And then as we go along, we can find, for most of the ranches in this country, feed costs are going to be the largest expense. And so anything that they can graze is going to be cheaper than anything you can deliver on a truck, and probably of higher quality too. So if we can have enough control of the animals to permit us to grow a stockpile of forage during the season and then ration it out after that growing season, then that's going to extend the period that they can be grazing and we don't have to be delivering stuff on a truck. So those sorts of issues of, but again, if the problem is we've got a 6-month calving window, then a new variety of X is not the immediate issue. There are other things to be, again, but that's management. That's the dance that you do when you're managing livestock on grassland. There's lots of levers that you can pull, but that's kind of the approach I would try to bring to the exercise.
Absolutely. Anytime we can move cows or critters to feed, rather than moving feed to critters, we're going to save money and time and all those things in the long run. When you're willing to count every cost in that supply chain, it gets pretty out of hand pretty quickly.
I heard one gentleman describe Missouri as a recreational haymaking state because half of the hay that gets made never gets fed.
Huh. Wow.
And that's, you know, they didn't need it, which meant that they didn't graze as many cows or critters as they could have, right? So they didn't need to make that hay, but they did anyway. Or they had, you know, storage losses, or when they fed it out, they had tremendous feeding losses. And so you put all that together and, you know, what does it cost to make a ton of hay? And the hay that you feed is never as good as the hay that you cut. It can't be.
Right.
There's no magic here. It's a degrading process. And in fact, you could have been better off grazing, putting that through a grazing animal earlier than letting it become a mature hay crop. But there's lots of ways to look at things. And sometimes we just do things because that's how we've always done them. and that's not always a good reason for still doing them that way. There's sometimes, you know, frequently there's good wisdom there. I don't mean to be disregarding it completely, but at least pause to say, why am I spending, you know, $90 or $80 a ton to make hay when I can buy hay into my barn cheaper from somebody local who's making hay and doing it on a bigger scale or whatever? Those sorts of questions.
Right. Yep. Even here in the, we're step climate, you know, 14, 15 inches of rain per year. You find people with hay piles from good years that are, you know, the deer have climbed on top of them to the point that they're disintegrating into the ground. And so it's even here in a good year, like we had 2 years ago, more hay gets made than you could possibly feed. And so, you know, there's even here we have that waste that happens. And so it's always interesting what, you know, we could have brought more outside animals in maybe and grazed those. Oftentimes the limiting factor again is infrastructure. I tell my wife all the time, we drive past farm fields and hay fields without fence around them. I start to break out in hives. I'm like, there's opportunity there for something if we were willing to just think a little bit differently and approach it from a little bit different angle. Mm-hmm. Are there best practices in each context? Is there typically a limiting factor in sandy soil and that doesn't exist in maybe a heavier clay soil? Are there some of those things that can kind of help start us in the right direction? Or is it always kind of that process that you laid out of estimate yield, track production, and look for the low spots?
Well, yeah, I suppose it would be easy to imagine that if you had uniform rainfall across sandy soils and clay soils, you'd probably be able to get longer use out of the sandy soils than the clay soils, especially with large animals. There would be the hazard of treading damage on the heavier soils. So that would be one concern. Sometimes heavier soils might be slower to warm up in the spring, so they might be a little slower to provide spring growth. On the other hand, sandy soils, depending on the structure, could be more droughty than the heavier soils. So you get costs and benefits with each one, and I would hate to make a hard and fast rule about sandy soils are always, I don't think I could make it, about always limiting versus heavier soils. Clearly, they are different in how they need to be managed in terms of fertility. You know, a sandier soil is not going to be able to hold the nutrients that a heavier soil is going to be just because of the nature. But if we can manage them properly, we could see an increase in organic matter to do the best that they could do. We're not going to change its texture, but we could, depending on how it had been managed before, do a better job with maintaining or increasing organic matter content, which is really important for holding both moisture and nutrients. The other thing with the sandy soil, especially depending if you get into parts of Nebraska, for example, and you don't want to see that sod get broken, because as soon as that happens, now you've got erosion problems and things like that. So there are challenges there that I would be aware of, but again, case by case. And
that's the hardest part of this kind of a podcast, right? Asking the question that doesn't get answered with "it depends."
Yeah. That phrase was in my mind, but it's like, I've already played that one once. Let's.
Yeah. No, I guess, do you see the Liebig's barrel as a useful tool in other areas, say people management, land management, animal management, financial management? Can you see it being applied to those other areas as well?
Well, sure. I think that there's a version of this that was called Pareto's principle, 80-20, kind of rule. It's somewhat related, at least in my mind, the idea that, 80% of your problems come from 20% of your customers or your employees or whatever. I mean, 80% of the improvement can come from the critical 20% if you identify it properly, right? So I see it in that way having application to basically everything in life. We can never get everything to 100%. And if we try, we're going to, I think, waste a lot of time and money and heartache trying to do that. Again, we're in agriculture, we're not in manufacturing. So there's a lot of variables that are imposed on us. So the best that we can do is, sort of shoot the average and be prepared to respond one way or the other. But still, that this, if we can identify for example, feed costs. If feed costs are, 80% of your operating costs, I'm making up a number. I don't think that's too far off from an industry average. Well, clearly cutting those by a third is going to have a bigger effect than cutting any of the other costs by a third. So that kind of an approach, and I think that certainly has guided a lot of engineering, and I don't see why it shouldn't govern this kind of a, especially as you say, this, we're now beyond agronomy 101 or animal science 201. We're now talking about, financial management and, transition planning and personnel management and any of the other aspects that impact ranch life.
How do we determine good enough when we're measuring in these things? Is it always just we're going to continue to measure and we're going to continue to look for that short stave and it's going to change from year to year, and so we'll focus on that one? Or how do you think about that?
Well, part of it is your goals. What have you established? And somebody said something about, if you haven't written them down, are they really goals? So is what we did this year getting us closer to the goals that we set for this decade, or this generation, or this year? We should have goals of varying timelines for any operation. But there has to be that kind of input, evaluate response, reevaluate cycle that goes on to say, and because if I don't care where you live, the nearest the nearest experiment station is not as close as the fields that you're managing. And so everything that we do, we ought to look for ways for us to constantly test ourselves and say, you know, I thought this was a good idea based on whatever reasons, and did it pan out or not? And the panning out is, you know, I put in X number of dollars and I got Y amount of response, and was that worth it? Did I have to borrow the money to, you know, did that create additional stress? You know, I did this, but it required that I had to have some extra help to do it. You know, so let's make sure we're accounting for everything that goes into it, because at the end of the day, it might be that doing nothing is the most cost-effective solution, but we don't know that if we haven't accounted for what we're doing, what we're getting back, the responses. I'm getting nervous about people who are advocating for some management based on their theory that it will achieve positive results without any description of what the objective measures of those responses would be. And I'm all for response driven process or results driven process. I'm also going to advocate for that through managers understanding what sorts of options do I have to achieve those results, rather than, you know, any one particular one size fits all approach, which is not going to work in any endeavor of human nature.
Yeah. That's why we always say it depends, right? You know, one of the things that I've been thinking about lately, as an illustration, is that we can make small changes and have small results, basically. But if we want to make big changes, we get maybe sometimes get bigger results. And I guess what I'm thinking of as an illustration is this idea of a lever. You know, if you're closer to the object you're trying to lift with a lever, you've got to push harder. But if you get way out on the end of that lever and push down on it, sometimes, or the lift gets easier, I guess. And so I think that sometimes we spend too much time maybe close to that lever, close to that weight we're trying to lift on that lever, rather than getting out to the end of it and getting a little bit more result for the same amount of effort.
Well, I guess I would only say, where is the fulcrum, right? Because if the fulcrum is closer, then, right, yeah, okay, so to use that analogy. But still, I yes and is the response. We need to make sure, again, management is an action, manage is an action verb. And so we understand what it is, the goal, we understand what we're trying to achieve. And then again, I've seen a lot of sort of habitual kind of farming practices. We, you know, again, we've always done it this way. And the result of that is that people end up doing things without thinking about why they're doing them. It's just time to do them. And okay, maybe that's right. But maybe there would be another approach, or it's unnecessary. You know, like, you're doing it to achieve something. Maybe you could achieve that thing with a different method and it would be more effective, less impactful. Or maybe, in fact, what you're doing isn't achieving what you think it is, but we're not capturing the data to evaluate it. Or maybe there's a whole new way. So it just, we have tools available to us today to manage the information that we used to have shoeboxes and pocket notebooks and all kinds of other things. And then you still needed to somehow process that information. Well, now we can capture it and then process it very, very quickly, relatively easily, and give us answers that would have taken a lot more effort before. So,
Yeah, and I think you've probably spent more time in these circles than I have, but I've heard it said in the HRM circles that planning is a, and I can't remember exactly, but I think planning is a 16-letter word, or plan isn't a 4-letter word, it's a 16-letter word. We plan, we execute, we evaluate, we replan. I think that has relevance to some of the things we've been talking about here.
Yes, exactly.
What is your background? What has brought you to the point where you are as far as your career and the way you think and some of those things?
Well, I was trained as a forage agronomist and a ruminant nutritionist. I graduated in 86 from the University of Kentucky, moved to Oregon State University, where I was the forage extension specialist. From 92 until 2010, I spent what I call a wandering in the wilderness of working for high tech. And then in 2010, I was given the opportunity to come back into agriculture working for a forage seed company. Along the way, I developed another interest in human nutrition. And then starting in 2010, I began talking about something that I call grass-based health, which is this idea that ruminant animal agriculture uniquely gives us the chance to achieve healthy soils, healthy plants, healthy animals, and healthy people. And I've been given the opportunity to speak on that topic in a number of countries, sometimes to hundreds of physicians and clinicians who are getting continuing education, you know, medical education credits, listening to me say, this is a ruminant. Say it after me, ruminant. And over time, the number of people who have heard that and messages around that topic have been called the ruminati. And these are people who understand the fundamental importance of ruminant animal agriculture to present-day food systems, to humanity's past, and to humanity's future. And so I've been given the title of Don Pedro, the sod father of the ruminati. And again, trying to use what I think at least is humor to get a message across to people that much of what we've been told, there's just not good factual basis for it. And that cuts right across from production through consumption. And I'm trying to introduce these producer, consumer, research tribes to each other so that we can all learn from each other.
You mentioned University of Kentucky. Did you start out there, or were you from Oregon originally? How did that journey? No.
I was born and raised in Lower Bucks County, Pennsylvania, which is suburbs of Philadelphia. But I discovered very quickly I liked it more in the country than I did in the suburbs or the city. My undergraduate was completed at University of Georgia. My master's was at the University of Georgia, and then I moved to Kentucky. And as I said, my wife and I moved to Oregon because of the faculty position at Oregon State.
Your work now as with the seed company, how is that connected to the forage agronomist background and those things?
When I first joined them, I was the forage product manager. And now I am forage ambassador, which is basically advocating for the company, for the products, agronomic support, as well as advocating for ruminant animal agriculture.
And is that a consumer-facing position, or is that a producer-facing position, both?
Good question. Mostly it's the company I work for is a wholesale marketer, so we do develop new varieties on our own. We also license from breeders, either at land-grant universities or government agencies. We contract the seed production, And then we wholesale market. So we distribute through distribution chain, distributor, dealer, before it hits the farmer, or in the case of the low yielding varieties, the turf users, the short grasses. Mm-hmm. Sorry, it's a little dig I have to give to the turf people. The majority of what I do is going to be talking to dealers, distributors, or the farmer consumer. But occasionally there'll be others when I'm operating in that space. When I operate as, you know, Peter Ballerstedt, sod father, grass-based health, then I'm mostly talking to clinicians, physicians, individuals who are trying to restore their metabolic health.
And how does ruminant animal ambassador, I'm not sure if that's the term you use, but something along those lines, how does that work in when you're talking to farmers, ranchers, producers?
Well, the forage ambassador is the title for the company. Agronomic support, right. It's promoting concepts of forage management. So, for example, working to establish a calendar of forage production to fill gaps. Again, back to the point of let's extend the grazing season as long as we can. Or, for example, the beneficial non-toxic endophyte fescue variety. There will be a series of seminars put on by the Alliance for Grassland Renewal in March in the Southeast to try to teach how to replace the toxic tall fescue with the non-toxic novel endophyte infected tall fescue. So that would be another role that I fill.
Where has your experience taken you in your work? Has it been across the country? Are you fairly local there in the Willamette Valley? Mm. Where has your
experience have been this year?
Yeah. Yes. Touché.
Pretty well flushed my calendar, I can tell you. Yeah. I've gotten to visit New Zealand, Australia, Brazil, several visits into Alberta, Eastern Canada. This year, the plan was for another trip to New Zealand, one to Kenya, and one to Europe. Hopefully those meetings only got postponed. Mm-hmm. So we'll see what 2021 brings. Yeah. But fascinating things happening in Brazil. And in fact, I just did an interview with a young researcher that I first met there, and he's working on these, they have an effort in integrated livestock cropping systems. So one of the myths is that there's an either or between animal agriculture and plant agriculture.
Hear, hear.
And so what they're finding, so there was recently a paper that was published from this group that he's a part of, where they showed that fertilizing the forage during its cycle then is still there for the cropping cycle and produces more food from the same area of land than fertilizing the crop does. So now you're getting more food, same area, fewer inputs. And I got to see systems where they're growing trees wide spaced with grass or and crops, you know, sort of rotating while, you know, this is subtropical and tropical area. So trees are mature in 15 or 20 years. But those are systems that they're working on there. So that was an interesting thing to see.
What's exciting to you, given your network, given your travels? What is exciting to you in the world of ruminant animal agriculture?
I think the most exciting thing for me is there's several. One is there's a challenge ahead of us, and that is meeting the goals of 2050. You know, people have spoken about these for a number of years, but a key goal is meeting the increased demand for animal source food. And ruminant animal agriculture must be a part of that. And so the opportunities to improve the productivity and efficiency of ruminant animal agriculture globally in appropriate ways so that the resources are maintained or even enhanced is, I think, a huge challenge, but a huge opportunity. So that's exciting to me. I think we have a growing awareness of the value of well-managed grasslands globally. Mm-hmm. I think that people are becoming more and more aware of topics, but they're also becoming aware that they haven't necessarily been getting the whole story. And so we have an opportunity, if we'll learn how to do it better, to tell our story. Now, I'm not suggesting that everything's great and there's nothing that needs improving, but I am suggesting that it's a lot better than many people suspect. And, you know, for example, already in the United States, I think, I just did this interview, the anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions from agriculture, and I put agriculture in air quotes because that includes forestry and land use changes, right? So that's the bucket, 9.0% of the total. Mm. That's all of agriculture, wow. Plant and animal and these others. Okay. Yet at the same time, it's sequestering an amount that's equal to 11% of the total. So already in the United States today, agriculture in air quotes as practiced is carbon negative. Mm. Okay, well, that's a little different than we've been told, right? So now we can imagine that we could improve it in certain ways and make a bigger impact. But so I think that that's an opportunity for people to come to greater awareness of that. And we could talk about watershed health. We could talk about soil health. You know what? The FAO said something about we only have 60 harvests left at current rates of, which is a time scale shorter than any catastrophist talks about in terms of other threats. You know, there is no adaptation to a complete lack of our soils, right? and again, ruminant animal agriculture is going to play a part in that. And on top of all of that, or in addition to all of that, we have this burden on our society of chronic illness. And there are people who are showing that those illnesses, in some cases, can be completely reversed. Mm. And they can be part of a lifestyle that includes diets that are higher in animal source food consumption than we've been told is healthy. There's many stories here for us to talk about. That's what my podcast is about. But if more people get that experience, then they become greater allies for people who are operating ranches. And they become people who are more interested in uses of ranch land other than subdivisions, right? Or you know, we can make that ripple out. So those are things that I find exciting challenges, and I'm trying to encourage students to go into forage agriculture, to go into this area with a thought of, you know, 2050 is their professional lifetime, not mine. That's 30 years, I'm 64. Yeah, probably not. Part of my mission is also to find whoever's next, and help them, you know, kind of become the next sod father or whatever you want to call it, that not to be a replacement, but to take it on further.
What are some of the best uses of this idea of Liebig's barrel in managing you know, land, animals, people, money. What are some of the ways that we should be thinking about trying to apply this idea to the resources that have been entrusted to us?
Ooh, short list. First of all, no one should be applying fertilizer without understanding what they're doing in terms of what the need is. I'm not casting aspersions, but I've always been puzzled by people who buy fertilizer from the same people that give them their fertilizer recommendation. There might be a conflict there. Weed control, for example, if we don't, again, the grazing management, if we haven't had control of livestock to rest areas appropriately, many times the vegetation that we see is a result of the management that we're imposing. Not always. I mean, there are invasive species that need some significant response, but in many cases, it's a management issue. Again, if I can adapt Liebig's barrel to the 80-20 thing, then the clearest thing is the control of livestock to manage the forage resource. You could also look and say, how well aligned are your animals' nutritional requirements with the feed resources that your environment is going to provide on an average basis? And if they're way out of bounds, then you probably need to spend some time looking at those to get them better aligned. We talked about the calving interval. If you've, you know, got a nice tight calving interval, then you know, you could probably be looking at other aspects of reproductive management. But if you've got, like I said, a 6-month calving interval, then you probably need to be looking at that. Those are the sorts of things, if all of your area is in one predominant species, then you might well be limited by its growth pattern. But then again, it might be a function of the environment, and you're not going to shift that much by going to a different species. So understanding what the key limiters are and which ones you can manipulate effectively is probably an important awareness to have as you're building your management plan and goals.
A lot of this conversation has continually reminded me of something that they talk about in, and I'm not sure if it's other places too, but at least Ranch Management Consultants, the Ranching for Profit School, they talk about finding the dead wood, looking at what, you know, you've got a tree of production on your place, and there's something on that, in that tree that is a limiting factor. And maybe just stopping that, cutting that limb off altogether is the best option, but you've got to be looking at it from a systems approach and making sure that you're not going to also lose some benefit by lopping off that branch or whatever. So that has continued to come to mind as we've had our discussion today. Mm-hmm. And I think that, I guess, one of the things, being the Working Cows podcast, being centering around giving producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm challenging practices, what are some of the out of the box answers that people should be open to considering when they do look at their operation and recognize that this is the short stave in our barrel? Is it other species of livestock? Is it sheep? Is it chickens? Is it goats? Is it, you know, what are some of those out of the box solutions that you've seen people come up with, examples that you're aware of from your travels and your, exposure?
Yeah. I remember one example, someone, and it's not a ranch situation, but maybe as an example, their thought was they wanted the homestead. That was their image. And so tremendously diversified, they were going to do this and whatever. And what they discovered along the way is they could focus on producing culinary herbs under, you know, plastic hoop, you know, kind of thing, and make far more than they could with all these other enterprises. And that then became their business. And so the key thing for them was they had the original dream, but they had to hold that loosely enough to accept what came to them as they went along and say, oh, well, this is a better option for us. Our quality of life is better, you know, whatever. We still do whatever we want in these others, as much of that as we want to, but we're not dependent on them. This is the thing that's going to, you know, work for us. So that idea of we start with the initial idea, but then we can't be locked into that. You know, it's not my idea, and it hopefully is not such a paradigm changer. Well, maybe it is. We're grass farmers, right? We're not cattlemen. So wherever we are, there's a certain amount of grass that we can produce over a certain amount of time and then manage. And we're going to convert that into a saleable product through this wonder that's called a ruminant. Take your pick. Which one would you like? And that, you know, so the cow, she only pays you on 2 days, right? When you sell her calf or when you sell her. Other than that, so I think it's Jim Gerrish who talks about the job description for the cows that he wrote up, right? Mm-hmm. Yep. This is what I expect of them. This is what they expect of me. And then it's real clear that you need to keep those jobs clear. It's, oh, that's not my job. Mm. It's not my job. Your job is to deliver a calf, right? Without my interaction. Your job is to feed yourself, right? Your job is, okay. And my job is to make sure that the feed is there and that I give you access and you have water. And yeah. So those are some ideas I'd offer. And certainly Jim Gerrish is someone, full disclosure, he and I share the same major professor, although he was there a few years before I was. So, you know, there are far more successful academic brothers around the country that I like to point to and say, yeah, I'm one of his.
Yeah, you know, and that was, you know, Jim Gerrish talks about, you know, back to some of the things you were talking about, Russell Hurrow and Grubb and some of those things. Mm-hmm. And I think that the idea there is that if I've done everything in my job description, then if she can't hang here, so to speak, then she's got to go somewhere else. You know, we can't continually try to make excuses and put band-aids on and do triage and make sure that we've done everything that we're supposed to do. She's got to do her part.
Yeah, the fitting to the resources is critical.
And our management of those resources.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yes. Well said.
So, you know, it comes to mind, you talk about the growing herbs, I think it was. I think Gabe Brown says the most profitable enterprise on their ranch is the bees. And you talk about Greg Judy, or you look at Greg Judy, and he's growing mushrooms on wood planks at his place and selling them for a healthy profit, you know. So I think, and you know, even another one, Steve Kenyon sells bags of stinging nettle tea, you know, and that, you know, there's all kinds opportunities if we're willing to look. And a lot of times those opportunities are very, very low amount of input of effort. And as long as you've got the market for them, there's a high return there. So what are some indispensable tools that you think of for grass managers, grass farmers? You talked about capturing data, recording data, analyzing data as a big part of being able to understand what is the shortest stave. What are some indispensable tools that you look at as far as being able to capture, record, analyze, interpret data?
First of all, your brain. I mean, it's might sound flippant, but a lot of thinking is hard. And so doing that kind of observation and evaluation. Okay. So number one, number two, your eyes, number three, your feet. because in grass, you have to get out in and walk across and look down. If you look across from the edge, it looks a lot different than when you walk through it and look down. Mm. So, and then, you know, there are any number of things. I mean, as far as physical devices, I've seen people with rising plate meters, falling plate meters, electronic meters. I used to be real big on those when I had a budget to buy them. Funny. they're great. I mean, not meaning to say anything more than that. A meter stick, you know, with lines on it. I've even seen rubber boots that have, you know, something indicated on them, you know, when it's above your ankle, turn in, when it's, you know, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Again, whatever you're going to do, make it consistent. So that's another one, is just the consistency of keeping these records. It's got to be something that you're going to maintain, because if you only do it for half the year. And then in terms of managing just the computer with Excel or whatever the spreadsheets are called these days, allows you to build essentially a database, and then you can extract the information from that. So if people aren't comfortable with those tools, there's lots of resources online to help us learn how to use the technology that exists.
Before I had Dylan Biggs on the podcast for the second time, I said, if there's evidence that we need more, cow focused, regenerative agriculture podcasts, it's that it took me 135 episodes to get back to having Dylan Biggs on. Another one of those individuals is Logan Pribino. Been a long time since I had him on. I've only had him on once, but he posted on Twitter, the best thing that a person can add to their field is their shadow. That get out there, look at it, analyze it, get a feel for it.
I think there are always Chinese proverbs. Maybe they are, maybe they aren't. But, you know, the best fertilizer is the footsteps of the farmer.
Very good. Very good. Show notes page for today, workingcows.net/171. Any links that you want me to put there? Links to your podcast, other links to your Twitter profile, anything else?
You can put in email address, peter.ballerstead@gmail.com. You know, all the social media accounts are fair game. Grass-based on Twitter and Instagram. Grass-based Health is a Facebook page, as well as a blog on Blogspot. You can find Peter Ballerstead on LinkedIn. And then, yeah, the Meet Your Herdmates Sodcast on YouTube, or most of the, what do you call them? You call them
platforms.
Yeah, podcast platforms. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So most of them now have picked it up, but I'm hosted on Podbean.
Good deal. Well, I appreciate you starting the Sodcast and taking that leap. And
thanks for listening.
Yeah. And exposing people to your network and your knowledge base. I really appreciate it. And
I might have to invite you on to talk about what it's like to be a ranching podcaster, and you know what it's like to live in your part of the world and what your day looks like. I mean, so many people have no idea. Mm. You know, there's a certain amount of romance associated with many people's ideas of agriculture, and yeah, okay, I get it, but it's not so romantic in, you know, January or.
I hope I just started my pickup for the last time to feed my animals, because I got all my bales set up for bale grazing. So we'll see how that goes. But hopefully.
Yeah.
And they've been swath grazing since September. So that's been
nice.
Good. Yeah, I'm really enjoying that. It's been really good to have my own piece of land. I was just talking to somebody the other day. I'm also in the first chair, so to speak, in a church for the first time in my life. I've been a pastor for 12 years, youth and associate pastor.
Really?
Yeah. And now I'm the only pastor at a small country church. And I said, you know, it's really nice to be in a position where the buck stops here, essentially. Like I can see issues on my land. I can see issues in my church, and the only one responsible, or not necessarily, but you know what I'm saying, the only one responsible for making changes is me. And I can see those issues and I can try to affect change. And if I fail, it's not because somebody else higher up in the supply chain, in the food chain, didn't do their job. It's because I didn't do my job well. And that's a good thing. You know, I've been in that other position for a long time where you don't get to make those decisions. You can make recommendations, but somebody can veto them. Mm-hmm. So I'm really appreciating this opportunity. But
well, good luck with everything that's happening in your life. It sounds like a pretty momentous change over the last year.
Yeah, it's been good. It's been good. But Peter, thanks for your time today.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Clay, for reaching out. I appreciate it.
And we did get around in some bonus material to talking about grass-based health and about kind of different diet strategies. And so I want to share with you a little sample of that that's going out as a Patreon bonus episode. You can support the podcast at workingcows.net/support. Patreon support can be found at patreon.com/workingcows. So much appreciate all the support. Somebody anonymously sent me 3 microphones, perfect timing for going to Ranching for Profit here. At the end of this week, I'm taking off for Cheyenne, Wyoming to the Ranching for Profit school with my wife. We've got 3 microphones. I plan to record, daily, kind of updates of our time there and what we're processing, what we're thinking about, and who knows, maybe pull somebody else into the hotel room for recording as well. So really appreciate that. So appreciate all the support. Here's a preview. Here's a little taste of what we talked about with Peter Ballerstedt about grass-based health, about ketogenic diet, about therapeutic low carb reduction. Neither of us being doctors or nutritionists, or, well, he's a doctor, but not a doctor of medicine, so to speak. So anyways, here's that preview, and listen to that and head on over to workingcows.net/support or patreon.com/workingcows if you want to support the show and get access to bonus content like this. So, very good, very good. But I would like to continue for just a little bit, you know, however, 15, 20 minutes, whatever, and talk a little bit about grass-based health. You know, this will be bonus content for people who support me through Patreon, and it's anything's on the table. I'd like to hear a little bit about how you think about that. I listened to the Vinnie Tortorich episode and went and found Fat, a documentary. And I think that, I won't say the best part of that documentary, but a very good part of that documentary was Gary Taub's interaction with the American Heart Association lady. And that was just fascinating to watch, kind of the somebody coming in with a paradigm challenge and dropping it right in the middle of the table and watching people react.
Yes. Yeah. Kind of like a rude noise in church. You know? we don't know what to do with this. Right. Let's just ignore it. So let's start with anyone in animal agriculture needs to understand and deeply understand that there has been a longstanding movement against the consumption of animal source food, their product, not based on science, but based on belief. And there has been something that's been masquerading as science that then has sort of combined with that and ended up producing the dietary guidelines in the late, in 1980, and we're just getting a new version now. And it's not a scientific process.
I'm not totally sure where I'm going next week. I know we will have that content coming out, probably be all of the day's debriefs smashed together into one episode, and that would be in a couple of weeks. I've got a couple of leads on some really interesting projects that I'm trying to nail down in the next couple of weeks. I might get one of those out for the next episode. But for now, thanks again for all the support and all of your communications and reaching out to me, and we'll see you again real soon with another episode of the Working Cows podcast.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.